Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, everybody. Lovely to be here. Following on from what Guy said, let me just give you a very quick rundown on what the Land and Water Forum was and what it did. So the Land and Water Forum was a body consisting of 58 major water user interests and other groups with serious interests in water. And they ranged very broadly from federated farmers to fish and game, from five Great River Iwi to Fonterra, from forest and bird to the mining industry, and from Meridian Power to local government. So it covered the entire spectrum. And that plenary of 58 interests asked a smaller group, which was called the small group, of 21 to help them by writing a report. And the 21 were assisted by six so-called active observers who came from central government and local government. So we covered the direct interests in water and people who were associated with its governance. This group assembled voluntarily, partly in response to a presentation not unlike the one Guy just gave you, which he gave in Waiheke a couple of years ago. And it established a mandate working with the government, who, when we did get a mandate, offered us funding and support. And after a year, we succeeded in reaching a consensus on a package of 53 integrated recommendations about the management of land and water in New Zealand. And since then, we've been taking it around the country. And we did a total of 18 calls in different regions, 18 workshops in different regions, and we've talked, as Diana said, to about 1,200 people. When we started, most people thought it would fall over by lunchtime. Now that we've finished, there's a little queue to join. So I'm not quite sure what it is you would want me to say to you about this process. Guy's here like the alpha and the omega at the beginning and the end, and I'm going to say something in the middle. I don't think you want to hear from me about what the Land and Water Forum report says, though if you do, you can always read it, and it's on www.landandwater.org.nz. You can get it and you can read it. It's tempting to tell war stories, but they are interesting mostly to former combatants. And I kind of feel that my own exposure to collaborative processes, although it isn't exclusively restricted to this one, has been a bit narrow for me to be too bold in drawing lessons. So I feel in a bit of a muddle, like a man who woke up, got to the office and discovered that he was wearing a brown belt and black shoes. So what I will do instead is to try and come at some insights about how this process felt, how we kind of did it internally, how you can make this kind of thing work, if you like, in real life. And I'll begin with thinking about, we've actually just written a piece of paper in the forum about collaboration, which we're going to put up on our website when we've finally perfected it, and you can see that there too, if you like. And in it, we derived a series of defining characteristics of collaboration, which is not unlike, actually, more the first list that Guy put up than the second. But you'll notice there are a lot of points of contact between what I'm saying and some of the prerequisites or requirements that he identified. And I thought I'd run through them. And I'm going to begin by saying that we concluded that to be successful, a collaborative process has to be open to all interested groups to send their own representatives, and in New Zealand it has to include iwi participation. Iwi participation is easy. If we hadn't had iwi in the forum, we would have had to start all over again when we got to the end. They're the treaty partner. Their presence, it seems to me, is simply required. But let me go to some slightly more tricky questions. How do you know if you've got all the people you need? Well, the way I explained it to myself is that you kind of have to have around the table all those people who can effectively say no. And then there's a question, well, do you exclude some people because you think they're really not very collaborative? And I thought Guy answered that. You don't just get the person from, let us say, Federated Farmers, who you might think is most akin to your views. You get the person whom they want to carry their flag. And they sent us a man called Lachlan McKenzie, who one might not have thought at the beginning of the process was going to be the stalwart of the collaborative process, which in fact he turned out to be, and he carried our banner right round all of the regional engagements. What do you do if you've got too many people? Well, there are various ways in which you can handle large groups, and one of the ways is turning them into smaller groups. We had a small central negotiating group which liaised with the large groups. We also broke the small central group, the small group, down into working groups that we could manage with. Project groups are another possible approach. So there are various ways in which you can break groups down, though you have to bear in mind that you have to build them up again as you come to the end of your process. Our process, and I think this was really important, was organic. It was based on people coming because they wanted to come. They were still able to come right up until the time when we got halfway through and we thought it's time we stop now, because anyone arriving now would be too late, really, to understand what had gone before. So the fact that it was organic strikes me as being very important. We decided we needed to operate with a consensus rule. So what is a consensus rule? Well, classically, a consensus rule is a rule which says that provided no one speaks against a proposition, the proposition can be adopted. Everyone has to agree enough not to say that they disagree. And why did we have a consensus rule? Well, Guy said some of it. I would say that what it means, essentially, is that you are forced to reach beyond a simple majority. You're forced to reach beyond yes, no. And that is essential if what you're trying to do is to break down polarity and seek a range of benefits for all. And in the Land and Water Forum, an early decision that we made was that whatever we came out with had to have benefits for all the participants and all of their values, not for some at the expense of others. So I think for those reasons, consensus was required. But if you have a consensus rule, does this mean you've given the veto to everyone? Well, maybe in theory, but I would not say in practice. In practice, the emphasis has to go on reaching agreement and not on being able to sustain your disagreement. And in practice, what you find is that a consensus rule puts enormous pressures on standouts. Once this consensus starts to happen, it's extremely difficult, and it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to stand against its development. Once you get a roll on, it's great. If you can't reach a consensus, what do you do? Well, one answer is you set out your options. You need to make progress even in the absence of final or full agreement. And if you read our report, you will see that we did reach a consensus. We reached a very full consensus on the report. But within it, there are a couple of areas where, for one reason or another, we thought that there was more work to do, and we set out some options. And it seemed to me, at any rate, that it's better to have more than two. Again, because polarity is a thing that you want to avoid. Our list said you need an independent and skilled facilitator stroke chair. Well, we had a facilitator and a chair, and so I'm going to make an artificial distinction between their roles. The facilitator was skilled, and the chairman had a lot to learn. The facilitator, who was Glenn, had to be knowledgeable about the processes that groups of humans go through when they're trying to reach an agreement. I remember one time when Glenn, using the florid metaphors of what's that word I'm looking for? Turning alchemy, told me that what we were faced with was instability in the crucible, but not instability of the crucible. And I found that very comforting. It enabled me to go ahead. And the facilitator also needs to know and be able to talk about how to work with the mood of a group, and groups' moods do change as they go along. As for the chair, I think the chair had, and I think would always have, to be independent, because to build trust, especially when you're dealing with such a range of such strong interests, you have to be able to show that you're not conflicted. I had to be clearly the servant of the process and not of someone outside the process. And that went to the way in which we set up the process and its reporting obligations and pay and rations questions as well. So, most fundamentally, I think the role of the chair was to listen. And I think the reason that you've got to listen, and Guy said a bit of it too, the reason that you've got to listen is because no one person is the repository of truth. And also because, as my mother used to say to me, very annoyingly, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. And so if you want to persuade people, you have to make them feel that you have listened to them enough for the answer that comes out to address what their real concerns are, to deal with them where they're living. And that requires a lot of listening by the chair and by everybody in the process. The purpose of my listening was partly to provide structure and direction within meetings and between them. People need to know what they're coming together to do and how they're progressing. And that goes to working out project plans and agendas and summaries of position, or causing them to be worked out, and focusing on agreement. You have to focus on agreement. I can remember an occasion in the plenary when somebody said, well, please tell us about those things which you don't agree about. And I declined, because the whole of the business is on bringing people together, and as disagreements arise, bringing them back into the fold. And I think you can encourage this and articulate it and assist it in various ways. And one is by constructing straw men, by constructing things which purport to be a possible conclusion that we could all reach, and giving them currency within the group. And I think you also have to mediate between the group and the wider polity, between ministers, industries, and the public, in order to garner support, because perceptions are very important. And people are much more likely to be constructive within the group if they think that there's a widening expectation outside the group that they're actually going to reach an agreement. Guy mentioned the importance of the provision of information and of the provision of a resource for the group to be able to do its work. The critical thing about the information which you put between groups of this kind is that it needs to be seen to be impartial. It has to be trusted. And you have to remember, however, that getting it takes both time and money. Information, in some senses, does not grow on trees. To a big extent, we got our members to provide it. And I'll talk more about the way we did that later. We were also exceptionally lucky in that NIWA came along to an early plenary and said, in a moment, which I found heart-stopping in its generosity, that they said, listen, our institution and its resources are at your disposal. And that meant we were able to have a full two-day seminar involving, because they did better than they even said, involving not only NIWA scientists, but also scientists from a range of other institutions, regional councils, universities, CSIRs. We had a whole range of scientists who briefed us for 2 days on the state of water in New Zealand and the reasons why it was in that state. Which leads me to the question of resources. The cost of processes like the Land and Water Forum is not low. They involve travel costs, they involve meeting costs, they involve the cost of a secretariat, and I absolutely agree with Guy about the importance of having a well-skilled secretariat. It's part of the business of establishing your independence, if you like. There's the huge cost of people's time, most of which, in our case, they picked up themselves. Processes need funding, and how they're funded goes to that very delicate question about dependence or interdependence, and I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. But first, let me come to the question of a mandate. We believe that processes like ours need a mandate from a public decision-making body. Unless all the decision-makers are going to be involved in your project, then you need a mandate from them to proceed. However inclusive our project was, we did not have a democratic mandate. Nobody had elected us. And so if your process is going to have legislative or regulatory implications, then in the final analysis, the decision has to lie with people who have regulatory or legislative powers. And the members in the process, the members of the process need to know this. They will put the time and energy which reaching consensus requires, and it's huge, they'll put that into a process only if they believe that that's a better way of influencing decision makers than is otherwise available to them. No mandate, no gain. So the forum's dilemma is that the forum's dilemma, which it had when it started up, which is a nice sort of encapsulation of the dependence-independence issue, is that to get government support, we had to agree on what we were prepared to do for the government. But to get agreement on what we would do for the government, we needed the government's support. You need a realistic time frame within which to complete your work, and that's associated with a mandate. It's unlikely to be as long as you would wish, but it's essential if you're going to bring the process to an end. And it really needs to be, and I'm going to say realistically, respected. We did find in the middle of our process there was a terrific uproar because the government did various things in Canterbury. And it nearly bust us, and we lost a click or two trying to deal with that. And ministers kindly said they accepted that this had occurred and they were prepared to give us an extra month, and boy, did we need it. So I want to make two final observations, and they're still around this theme of dependence and interdependence. The forum, in my view, succeeded because it was not run by the government. It required the participants to confront the clashes or the coincidence or the convergence of their interests themselves and find a way through. They had no alternative. There was no big daddy whom they could appeal to. And ministers had told them that they would not accept any backdoor lobbying. In the final analysis, the participants knew that they had to depend on the understanding and the trust that they could build up. They had to have a sense that their views had been taken into account and that agreement was better than no agreement. And in all of those senses, we had to be independent. And because we were independent and because we went through that process, I think we produced, as a fascinating and unexpected byproduct, an amazing amount of social capital. But the forum also succeeded because it was run for the government, which gave it its mandate and gave it funding and, in an important sense, gave it power, because the government promised to entertain the implementation of its recommendations. So the forum has to remember that its mandate came from the government, and it's the government that gets to decide. It had to steward the resources which the government gave it. It had to understand how the government viewed the world so that it could address those issues plausibly. The government, and I'll use a bureaucratic formulation, the government may wish to remember that it mandated the forum and that the members of the forum invested in it heavily. The government is not compelled to do what the forum recommended, but unless it takes the forum's consensus seriously, then if it didn't take the forum's consensus seriously, then we would have wasted our time and the social capital that we developed would disappear. So that's where I'll stop for now. Thank you very much. Yeah.